The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by 5 local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, and the Dayton Public Library.
Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'll be bringing you the Book Nook in just a few moments. Today, we'll be featuring a debut novel set in 1953 as the Soviet dictator Josef Stalin was close to death. Some very interesting things were happening in Russia, and Paul Goldberg has imagined some of those things. It's a fascinating novel called The Yid. We'll be talking to Paul Goldberg about it. But first, let's check in with National Public Radio News for the news headlines. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Paul Goldberg. He's just published his first novel. It's called The Yid, and he joins us by telephone from our nation's capital. Hello, Paul.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me.
Paul, today, as we're recording this interview, it is the official publication date of The Yid. Are you excited?
Oh, my God, yes. I've always wanted to publish a novel. I've been writing novels forever. This is my first published one. I've written books, but it's all been nonfiction until now.
So you've been practicing?
I have been writing, yes, a lot. And nonfiction is great, but this is special. This is kind of where we live.
Paul, I have read The Yid. And so I understand what the title means, but if someone was just to walk into a bookstore and see the book sitting there with the title The Yid, I think some people might find that somewhat provocative. What do you think?
Well, I don't really mind provocative. What I really was going for was a way of claiming one of the most vile myths ever really constructed in human history, which was the idea of blood libel. The Jews used blood for rituals. I mean, this goes back to at least 12th century or so. And there have been anti-Semitic trials based on this and novels as well. And what I really was going after was that. And just basically, I wanted to just kind of imagine what the ritual of that would be, which is actually absolutely absurdist. And I also wanted to make a novel out of Stalin's anti-Semitism, his final anti-Semitic campaigns. Then along the way, somebody suggested, actually it was my fiance who suggested that I name the book The Yid, and I thought, my God, that's perfect, because I was already claiming something much larger. I mean, you know, but this is mythology that produced The Merchant of Venice. I was basically playing on that terrain, and then suddenly somebody suggests, oh, why don't you just call it The Yid? And I said, oh, that actually makes perfect sense. So I was already on pretty provocative ground, and then it was just a matter of honesty to call it something else, to call it this.
And The Merchant of Venice is a Shakespeare reference, and if you read The Yid, you'll figure out what that's all about. Paul Goldberg joins us. His new novel is The Yid, set in 1953, which is the year when the Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin finally died. And he was quite debilitated at that point, wasn't he? In your book, it almost seems like he's completely out of it.
Yeah, he's out of it. It's kind of an interesting exploration of what happens when a tyrant is near death. I mean, they don't just go into retirement for the most part. Somebody has to do them in. And that's really the novel, to a great extent. His final days, or really final hours. Before his death, reportedly, he was planning to exile all Jews. The trains were coming, supposedly. Well, there was also, of course, the doctor's plot. That was a crazy idea, which actually isn't all that crazy when you think about it. When an older, or in this case, quite old, sick man who is losing it suddenly stops trusting doctors. You can just stop, you know, you can start missing appointments, or you can, if you're at Stalin, you just start killing doctors. So that was his plan. And then since he's killing doctors, some of them are Jews, or quite a few of them are Jews, why not just move all the Jews out to Siberia and above the polar circle somewhere? So that's kind of the novel. It begins actually with actors, but it does include some doctors. And since he was afraid of the doctor's plot, I said, why not have an international Jewish conspiracy, exactly what the thing that he feared, and have it in action, and then maybe have it do the right things. And that's really the novel.
Paul Goldberg joins us. His novel is The Yid, just came out today. Paul, I think we probably should tell our listeners that this is a personal thing for you. You got the ideas, some of the seeds of this when you were just a kid, and you grew up in the former Soviet Union. You have your roots there, and you know a lot about this, and you had access to veterans of the Great Patriotic War. You based some of this on people that you knew, people that were relatives. Tell us about yourself, where you came from, and how you ended up here.
Yeah. Well, I was born in 1959 in Moscow. This is 6 years after these events. I was aware of the fact that there was such a thing as the Moscow Yiddish Theater, and that there was this incredibly important production of Lear that was done in Yiddish, King Lear, Shakespeare's King Lear, done in Yiddish in 1935. And it was playing along with this is the novel is that story. And then of course I was very close to my grandfather, who took me around, and I met a lot of his friends, and I started listening to their stories, and I listened to my grandfather's stories, some of which were just concoctions that were just wild, that were done for my benefit, they were just made up. I met his friends who were also telling stories. So it's kind of like strong Jews who had been through the war and who wandered around and talked about what happened in 1942, for example. It was always a fascinating thing to listen to. At one point, I started collecting Moscow urban legends. And this would have been about 10 years after... it would have been in 1969, so I was 10 years old. My friend's father in the central of Moscow points out an apartment building entryway and said, here in 1944, they arrested a Jewish woman for having killed a Russian girl and using her blood in the matzahs. And I came home to my parents, and they said, what in the world is that? Do we actually do that? And they then, of course, explained to me how old these myths are and how vicious. I mean, it's entirely possible that this woman was arrested. It's also entirely possible that, who knows, she might have killed somebody. But the rest of it is just utter nonsense and vicious nonsense. But then I started thinking about it, that, you know, a myth is a very powerful thing. And that's what the Yid is about, is the mythology of and the power of mythology. And that is kind of the terrain on which I ended up. But I also ended up knowing a great deal, doing a lot of oral history over time, with speaking with older people who had been there in 1953. And imagining all of this.
My guest is Paul Goldberg. His new novel is The Yid. And you just mentioned your grandfather. And when we read the book, there's an ensemble cast of characters here. But we discover that one of the peripheral characters is inspired in some part and named after your grandfather. And he's really the hero of this story. And what he does is so amazing. You've got to read the book to find out what this guy does because, wow, I mean, you've got some pretty wild action in here.
You would think it's impossible, yeah. You would think it's impossible to do what he did. But, you know, in a way, it's a dialogue with him. When I was maybe 3, 4, 5, he started making up war stories for my benefit. And, you know, about being a partisan in the woods and then marching with the regular Red Army into Berlin and all sorts of stuff he didn't actually do. But the stories, I can probably retell you some of those stories. They were extraordinary. His real life was also quite heroic. But this was entertainment, so he was making the stuff up. Uh-huh. And so I decided, well, you know, I'm making something up. This is fiction. Why do I need another character when I had my grandfather to use on this? He probably would have really loved it if he saw that I actually did this. But yes, I conveniently wrote out my mother and her brother and my grandmother. This was just sort of a lone wolf fighter who does something really extraordinary. And he would have, what he actually did was also quite extraordinary. He was he spent World War II in as a pharmacist at military hospitals right behind the enemy lines. A few times the hospitals were destroyed by the Messerschmitts. He did quite a bit, and he lived his whole life as an honorable man and maintained his integrity throughout while living in a corrupt state. So that's quite a bit. And then, you know, and then he influenced me in a very major way. This book wouldn't have really happened because I wouldn't have really understood that it's okay to sit there and make up a history. And not so much make it up, but kind of let it happen between the real raindrops of history. I mean, my characters, all of the history in the Yid, chunks of it actually did happen. The characters, what they do to Stalin, that did not happen. That's my fantasy, but it's the milieu is not something I made up. It was all there.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Paul Goldberg. We're talking about his novel, The Yid, and we're going to get into the characters in the story. But first, this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. My guest is Paul Goldberg. His novel is The Yid. Let's talk about some of these characters. You mentioned the actor during the first segment, and the actor is a guy named Levinson, and he is the Yid, isn't he?
He is one of them. I'm actually being deliberately ambiguous here. Another person who could qualify as the Yid is another character we will get to in a minute. But I'm sure he's the next one that you're going to bring up. But Levinson is a fictional character. I ended up actually having him. The book begins with an arrest, or arrest that doesn't quite happen the way they usually happen. And so the secret police goons come to arrest an actor. The actor happens to live in my apartment in Moscow. He did not live in that apartment. I made him up. So it's actually, he's knocking on the door of the room where I spent the first maybe 10 years of my life. So Levinson is a veteran of the Civil War. He was a hero of the Civil War. He commanded a band of red guerrillas and that operated alongside the Trans-Siberian Railroad. He is in some way also based on a character from a Soviet novel, novella called Razgrom, or Defeat. It's by Alexander Fadeev. Who is also quite a slippery character. But he did have, I'm going to just try to do this by memory and then, while translating, so this may not be particularly wonderful, but I'll do my best. The way that novel begins with the following lines. His curved Japanese sword dangling on the steps, Levinson stepped down into the farmyard. So it's essentially, here is this hero of the Civil War named Levinson, who is actually, in this novella, he actually is defeated by the White Army. So, and in this case, Levinson, I decided to give him a different first name, different patronymic, and I also decided to figure out what his life would be like had he actually lived. And in this case, I decided to make him give him an obsession with theater. So he just, on a lark, joins the Moscow Yiddish Theater as it's being formed. And he becomes a commedia dell'arte clown, and he goes for the laughs all the time. So he's kind of a sad, angry clown.
Okay, our second one that you, I think, expect me to mention is has to be Alexander Kogan.
Yeah, Alexander Kogan is a character I also made up. He's kind of a composite of all the great docs I know, and he is a thinking man. He is certainly not a clown, the opposite of a clown. And he was he's one of Moscow's premier surgeons, just like the people who were then behind bars in 1953. And he is also having some real unpleasantness at work. And so Kogan is, again, the fictional character, and he begins as a his career first as a machine gunner in Levinson's detachment. So he takes many, many lives as a machine gunner. However, as a surgeon, he saves many more, and that's sort of his thinking is, has he evened out the score? And mm-hmm. He's totally opposed to murder, being a physician. In part, he's actually based on my friend's grandfather, who was a Red Army cavalryman in the Civil War, and he ended up becoming one of the Soviet Union's premier physicians. And in fact, it's kind of interesting. I was visiting this friend of mine in Israel, and in her apartment there is the sword that was given to her grandfather for his bravery in battle. Huh. And it's kind of interesting because they sort of let me play with that sword a little bit. And then my friend's mother, who's this gentleman's daughter, said, she basically said, well, he was using that sword before he became a doctor. So that kind of scene is, it's not in this novel, but it certainly is an inspiration for this novel, because here's somebody who knows how to use these weapons. He's used these weapons. He's not really ashamed of having taken lives, but this is not where he is right now. So this is the dilemma he faces in 1953. Does he want to kill anymore? And the answer is no, absolutely he can't. He doesn't want to.
The book is The Yid. Paul Goldberg wrote it, just published. And, okay, we need to talk about your most unusual character now, this guy Lewis. Wow, does he stand out?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. Lewis is... I did not make up Lewis entirely. He is also a composite. I would sort of argue that if I wanted to be really provocative, and I really don't care whom you consider the Yid in this book. It really is sort of it's a reader's choice. As a reader, I would probably call him the Yid, even though he is not at all Jewish. He is an African American. Here's what was really fascinating in the story. He is an enlightened worker, Marxist, who tries to join the Communist Party. And the appeal of the Communist Party at the time is that, you know, if you look at Marx, Marx negates race. So there is no race. It was very tough to be black in Omaha, where this guy is from, especially during the riots and the lynchings. So he joins the Communist Party and tries to come to the Soviet Union, and where the land where race is negated, right? There is no race. Mm-hmm. There are no black people. There are no colored people. There's nothing. It's just, you know, you are defined by your relationship to ownership of means of production. That's Marx. So he ends up trying to go there, but finds huge amounts of racism in the Communist Party of the United States. He actually studies Hegel. He studies Marx. He poaches a course in Hegel at the University of Chicago. And then eventually he just says, the heck with all of you, and gets a job with a company called the McKee Company of Cleveland, which actually did build the smelters in the Ural Mountains in the city called Magnitogorsk, which was really loosely modeled on Gary, Indiana. These are the smelters that ended up winning World War II. Mm. So he ends up working there. Now, to some extent, I'm drawing on somebody else's, another American's memoirs. There were lots of Americans in Magnitogorsk at the time. The name of the city is the Magnet Mountain. So the interesting thing here is then he starts discovering what race looks like in the real Soviet Union versus propaganda. So it's much more interesting than one can possibly imagine. And I've drawn on the memoirs of black communists who ended up in the Soviet Union to some extent. And to some extent, I kind of could get a sense of what it would be like. But there are a couple of things here that are fascinating. Since the Soviet Union's revolution in 1917 was believed, at least by some people, to be an international revolution, there was this thought that Lenin had that, and others, and certainly there was Comintern plans, race would become a factor, and that there would be black workers who would be coming to the Soviet Union in the name of world revolution to build communism. And some did. So what is interesting in the propaganda world is I have seen a silent movie called Little Red Devils, in which there's an American black character fighting at a band of young red partisans, and one of them is a black American, and they're fighting, you know, the white army. It's extraordinary to see that. And then there was also a really interesting movie called Circus, in which it's a Soviet musical, which features an American circus performer, a woman who has a secret. She has a black baby. Terrible, terrible secret. And what's fascinating with this movie, and this is 1930s, is once the secret is revealed in the circus, nobody sees, so what's the problem here? That's the propaganda view. And everybody just sort of sees this baby, and the baby is black, and everybody's really, you know, the circus audience is very, very nice and pleasant about the whole thing. And one of them, whose name is Solomon Michoels, sings him a Yiddish lullaby, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful scene. So Lewis is a kind of a way of exploring this whole idea of what race is like. And once you get into race and what it's like in the Soviet Union, what does it mean? What is he? You know, sometimes he feels like a revolutionary from the planet Mars. Sometimes he feels like a Jew. Sometimes he feels like like he's being surrounded by Nazis. And all of this is kind of true. It's just different at different times. And in the end, he becomes, you'll see it. But he speaks perfect Russian. He speaks perfect Yiddish. He speaks Esperanto. Why not? He's kind of a link to the outside. I needed to have an outsider because these characters are way too exotic. So I needed to have another exotic character who could kind of give them, put them in perspective. And that's Lewis. And to me, if I were to choose one of the characters that I would call the Yid, that would be Lewis. It wouldn't be Levinson. But you're welcome to suggest Levinson, and it really makes very little difference. It's a reader's choice.
Language is a big part of this story. Yiddish and Russian and English, and you have extended portions that are in other languages. Fortunately, you translate most of that for us because a lot of us don't understand Yiddish. And I love some of the encounters. You have these two thugs who are going around preying on Jews that they encounter. Uh-huh. As everyone's getting ready for this pogrom and their encounters, that's one thing that they do is they walk up to people who they think are Jewish and they say things about them and they don't think that they're going to be understood. Let's talk about Yiddish. We probably have some listeners out there who really don't know what Yiddish is.
Well, Yiddish is a European language of European Jews, which started to develop a very serious literature in the 19th century. It's Germanic. Although it's written with Hebrew characters, it's kind of a mixture of Slavic languages and kind of Germanic languages. It's also a language unto itself. There's also a little bit of Hebrew, quite a bit of Hebrew actually. And politically, it's been viewed as the language of the working masses. It's not the language of rabbis. It's also an awful lot of fun to listen to it. It's a language that Hitler killed in essence. That's one of his crimes against humanity. Yiddish is in chunks of it have been absorbed into the English language and really all sorts of other languages, many other languages. But it was also a language of art and literature, and one of the reasons for the Moscow Yiddish Theater was to enlighten and to kind of move the Jews into the world of real things. Hence, for example, there was a translation of King Lear. Now, what I wanted to explore was the process of translating Shakespeare into Yiddish. That was actually quite a project. I focused on a couple of plays. There's a little bit of Richard II, and then Lear is, of course, the biggest chunk of it. Of course, Lear is the story of a king gone mad. So that's very much appropriate for the story. Also, Lear is a story of a very confused monarch who makes some terrible mistakes, and that's interesting because we're sort of in 1935. He made the mistake of banishing Kent and banishing the right daughter while trusting the wrong daughters. Well, that's kind of where Stalin would have been during the Moscow trials in the 30s. In 1953, he's just stark raving mad. Mm. So Yiddish kind of allows you to look at how these Shakespearean plays can play in the context of the Soviet Union, what they mean, how they're different. And in this case, how do you actually make the translations? Because as a translator, you're not just taking the words and you're molding the words. So I looked at Lear's final lines and how they were translated into Yiddish and the choices that were made. It was also a very interesting process in this case because there were three people involved. One of them in this process of translating Lear, one of them was the director, Radloff, who spoke no Yiddish but spoke English. The other was the poetic translator, Shmuel Halkin, who spoke no English and really nothing else. Spoke Russian and Yiddish. And then there was the theater's artistic director who ended up playing Lear, and that was Solomon Michoels, and he spoke German and no English, and of course Yiddish. So, and Russian. So essentially you have these three guys fighting their way through Lear line by line by line. And it's interesting what turned out. Now, what we were talking about is sort of my own connections with this. The translator of this, of Lear, a gentleman named Shmuel Halkin, lived across the street from my father, from his dacha, for the final year of his life. And I was actually brought over across the street soon after I was born. So it's kind of interesting that I intersected, I certainly can't possibly remember this, but I intersected with Halkin on this earth, and we were actually in the same place at the same time, and I believe I was brought over there at one point. So it's kind of an interesting connection to some to events that are long gone.
Mm. My guest is Paul Goldberg. His novel is The Yid. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and the program will continue right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Paul Goldberg. We're talking about The Yid, his new novel. And on the cover of the book, there's a picture of this big black car. And this car is a character in the book, as far as I'm concerned. Tell us about this Black Maria.
Well, Black Maria is a vehicle that was used to collect people, arrest people, bring them back to the evil castle of Lubyanka, the secret police place in the center of Moscow. It's a prison and the place where people are interrogated and beat up or executed, of course. So a Black Maria is kind of an interesting piece of urban transport. I saw them as a kid, and I just always shuddered at the thought of being in the back of one of those things. It's interesting that there are different names for it in Russian. For example, in the poet Anna Akhmatova's Requiem, which is her description of the arrest of her son and just the years of terror in Leningrad, she uses the word Черная Мария, which is a Black Maria. I would have used the word Черный Ворон, which is something very, very similar, Воронок, which is kind of a fledging of a black crow. So I, it's a very ominous looking thing, but what it really is a Jeep like vehicle with kind of a little cage in the back, and you know people who are arrested are sitting in the back of that cage. Well, I ended up kind of claiming a Black Maria, at least one of them, because it becomes a piece of transport in which people who are not loyal KGB members or loyal Soviets for that matter, but maybe patriots, are able to blend in, to hide. And so it does become a character in the story. And it's kind of a redeemed Black Maria in a sense. It becomes that. But it is something really extraordinary when you think about it. Here are these. If you've ever seen the KGB building in the center of Moscow, I saw it often. Had very thick, heavy gates, and the gates would open, and transport would kind of something would drive out. It could be a black car, or it could be a paramilitary, a military vehicle. Mm. And in this case, I can kind of imagine this in very Shakespearean terms: the castle gates open, and something very evil pops out of there to come back with people who are arrested, who are about to be murdered, or something, anything. So it's kind of like the darkness in the center of the city.
Mm.
So that's the Black Maria. That's the thing that comes out of the evil, the gates of the evil castle.
I've never been to Russia, so I've never seen that building, but I have seen the KGB building in Vilnius. Does that count?
Oh, my God. It would be exactly the same thing or worse.
Yeah,
yeah.
Paul,
not as worse, but it's the same thing.
Something I've never really been able to wrap my mind around from my meager studies of this period and of these countries, I've never figured out why it is that there were so many loyal communists who were Jewish, yet there was so much anti-Semitism in Russia. I've never been able to reconcile this in my own mind. I mean, here we have Stalin getting ready to take all his Jewish citizens and ship them into exile. I don't get it.
Well, it's fairly easy to understand why somebody who is Jewish would become a communist in the Russian context, because of anti-Semitism of the czars. So at that time, the old Bolsheviks, a lot of them would be Jewish. You know, let's not forget about Trotsky, for example,
mm-hmm.
who was Jewish, of course, and many, many others. It's then, of course, there were the first Moscow trials, and really after that, there were huge amounts of, many of these Jews were killed. But then something interesting happens during World War II. And this is when my grandfather would have definitely joined the Communist Party. You could totally see how in the kind of a bipolar world of Hitler versus Stalin, one could go with Stalin very easily. People do hate things that are other.
Yeah.
So in that sense, probably this is where fascism and communists meet. That's really what I was trying to do with the Yid, is to show, to explore both of them and also throw in anti-Semitism and American racism as part of this into that same cauldron and kind of boil it and see what happens. So to some extent, I'm kind of boiling the cauldron as opposed to separating out the little ingredients that went into it and teasing them out.
I just noticed I neglected when we were going through the characters to mention another important character, and that's this young woman. Is it Kima?
Yes.
Let's talk about Kima.
She's completely fictional. However, had she not been fictional, she would have been a distant cousin of mine.
Oh.
She is, in this book, she is the daughter of a commissar named Yefim Tseitlin, who was the head of the Communist International for Youth, which is actually the organization that was trying to encourage the world revolution. Yefim Tseitlin was a first cousin of my grandfather's. He was executed in 1937 or 38. I don't remember which. I don't believe he had any children. But in this case, I needed to show what happens to the child of a martyred commissar. And in this case, Kima is perfect. Now, if you look at her name, it's Kima, K-I-M-A. K-I-M means Komunistический Интернационал Молодежи, which is, you know, Kim, Communist International for Youth. That was the organization her father ran. And that's also a cousin of mine, of course. What I wanted to do is show what it would have been like for someone to watch their parents being taken away and murdered. Also, another thing that happens to Kima is the death of her mother, who leaves a suicide note, but shoots herself and leaves a suicide note, but for some reason there's no gun. It doesn't usually happen. Most people who shoot themselves to death and leave suicide notes also leave a gun. In her case, this just didn't happen. So I wanted to create this character who was just all about revenge. Mm-hmm. And Kima is a young woman who has no sense of self-preservation whatsoever. She's not someone who would survive. She also really needs help. She needs treatment. And this is in part a very important part of the book, is what treatment she gets. I'm not going to say any more on
good.
That.
Okay. No spoilers here. The book is The Yid by Paul Goldberg. I love reading crime novels for a lot of reasons, and one of them is I like it when the bad guys get what's coming to them. And you have some aspects of that in The Yid. Some of the bad guys really get what is coming to them. And there's a lot of violence in here, man. Ooh.
Yeah. I don't know what to make of this, because there's as a writer, I'm the most nonviolent person you'll ever meet, but as a writer, I really like writing violence.
Uh-huh.
I will do what I have to with sex or love, but I'm okay with that. But really, it's just kind of happens. It's very, very, very interesting to write. And to some extent, this is kind of a ballet, really. And since I chose a more Shakespearean swashbuckling kind of steel-on-steel imagery in this book, or really a way of people resolving their differences, is very much from Shakespeare, then, yeah, it gets very violent.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it was a violent time.
Sure. Well, and also, it's really well done. I mean, you have some stuff in here where I just said, man, how did he ever think of that? Whew. Yeah, you've got to read the book.
Some of it I may have actually used. Some of it I may have actually adapted from something that actually happened.
Okay.
So.
Paul, we're running out of time here. I think we better talk about your day job. Tell our listeners what it is that you do.
Well, my day job is just a huge privilege. I cover cancer research. I own a publication called The Cancer Letter. I do a lot of investigative stuff, and also just a lot of stories about policy and money and just kind of getting at how the money is spent and who is playing fast and loose with science. I've done, and who is actually doing good science sometimes even. It's a publication that's not really read by many patients. It's read mostly by docs. Sometimes stories we do get into newspapers, and I've been on 60 Minutes a couple of times over stories I've broken. So I'm kind of, what I do is heavy duty reporting. This is a very nice break from that, but I also love my day job. I'm not going anywhere there. I'm just enjoying doing this.
You've got a couple of blurbs that are in the press materials from gentlemen who we've had on the program. One of them is another Emma Gray. He said, quote, "If you like books and you're okay with Jews, The Yid is the novel for you." Gary Steingart, he's the blurb meister.
Yes. It was very nice of him to give me this blurb.
Yeah, we've had him on several times, and he is really a great guy. And here's another guy. Here's another guy that gave you a blurb, and we had him on the program years ago. He says, "The best historical fiction I've read since The 7% Solution. If you aren't averse to blood, and if you love Russia and Shakespeare and Yiddish, Paul Goldberg's swashbuckling epic is for you." And that quote was from Kinky Friedman.
He is great. He is definitely a hoot. I just called him yesterday and told him that this is coming out.
Yeah.
And he gave me this blurb before I before the book was bought, way before. Mm-hmm. So I just called them and I said, thanks again for doing this, for giving me a blurb on it. And we chatted for a bit.
How's he doing?
We didn't chat that long.
Okay.
But he's going off on tour, so he's doing very well. And he did run for governor.
Does he still call his band the Texas Jew Boys?
Yes.
Does he?
I love his band.
Wow, they're great.
They still have it, I think. I mean, there are certain – I've seen them perform a few years back.
Yeah.
I'm sure it might be reconstituted here and there,
yeah.
But they're absolutely hilarious. Now, you know, in a way, there's a bit of his influence in the Yid, which is sort of why I know him, really. The influence is to look at what it means to be Jewish and then they remark in a very different and innovative way. Because here's this guy, born in Chicago, writing the most hilarious material based in part on his Jewish summer camps experiences, I guess, and then later just being just living in America. And he is really an acknowledged master of the Texas ballad. And, you know, he did run for governor. I think he actually did respectably well. I mean, nobody expected him to win.
Yeah.
Probably not even he.
He did okay.
My God, he is absolutely hilarious.
Well, he walked in here. He came into the studio. This would have been back in the 90s. And he had his big cowboy hat on. And he was carrying the biggest cigar I've ever seen.
Yes, that was his shtick. That is his shtick. I hope he's still smoking cigars.
Yeah,
I haven't asked him. I next time he's in Washington, we agreed that we'll try to get together. But I have no plans to end up in Texas, though I wouldn't mind if would be very interesting actually to run into him. But yeah, he has the biggest cigar and it sort of makes me wonder. He has a huge following in Europe. His books did well, I assume. They're great. They're fun. He has a following in Europe, and I'm just wondering what a European can understand. What is the appeal? I mean, obviously they understand a lot. Obviously they understand everything, but what is the appeal of a character like Kinky to a European? It's just an interesting question. I'm looking for an answer. I guess it shows how small the world is and how intertwined. And that, too, is kind of like what the Yid is about. I was trying to show how intertwined it was and small, even in the days of the final days of Joseph Stalin.
Paul, I have time for just one more quick question. If you can answer this in 90 seconds, you grew up in the Soviet Union. Here in America, we wonder, what's going on in Russia? What's up with Putin? Can you answer that in 90 seconds? Your opinion.
Oh, he scares me. Really, it's not. I can't even look at it as somebody who is Jewish. I can only look at it as someone who is a small D Democrat, and it scares me because there's somebody who grew up in the same institutions that were created by Stalin. He is completely about power in a very Shakespearean way. I can't even begin to understand how it is possible that we are where we are right now. It's a huge disappointment to me because I haven't been back in quite a long time. Because I really, to me, the moment where I just said, okay, I am done with this place, was when those buildings were blown up in Moscow. And interestingly enough, the gentleman who brought up those subjects was later murdered in London, Litvinenko. So he did bring up the subject of perhaps involvement on the part of Putin in this. So yeah, it's a kind of neo-Stalinist world where which I don't want to have any part of.
Well, Paul, it's been a pleasure to talk to you about the Yid.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. The book is The Yid. Paul Goldberg wrote it for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McKeonis. Thanks for tuning in. And that was our Saturday edition of the Book Nook, which comes your way every Saturday morning during the 7 o'clock hour. And on Sundays at 10:30, we bring you another edition of the Book Nook. And tomorrow morning, don't miss my interview with Ian Rankin. He is the leading mystery writer in the United Kingdom. We had him on the program last summer, and he had taken a year off. And he came back revived and all ready to write a new John Rebus mystery, and it is a humdinger. We'll be talking to Ian Rankin tomorrow. We caught up with him on book tour, and we talked about his new novel, Even Dogs in the Wild, in the Book Nook.